Yeah, I guess we can start. So, this is just copy and paste from the last slide of the previous lecture. So if you recall, I gave you an example of a simple annotated program. It was this factorial thing, and in that material, in that example, we have rules for assignment, sequencing, consequence, and while loops. So we convince ourselves kind of that we have some system which can be used for annotating programs. Module, of course, this business of having to deal somehow with arithmetical statements. And I finished the last lecture with the question of relative completeness. So I show you that our rules can be used for something, whatever it do, however easy this example was. But now we want to convince ourselves that the rules are as general as possible, if we assuming that we have an oracle for arithmetic. And I think that I mentioned briefly this notion of weakest, in this case, weakest liberal precondition. So again, recall that our extended notion of states consists of ordinary states and the non-terminating ones. And now, let's say that capital or semantic weakest liberal precondition for a given command and a given assertion, so postcondition, is just a collection of all those extended states which are such that after the execution of our command on this state, so it's if this state happens to be bottom and non-terminating state, of course this thing is also bottom. Such that the postcondition holds after the postcondition B holds after the execution of our command on this state. So actually, this definition I could give in this very same form, whether I was talking of weakest liberal precondition or original notion of total or of weakest precondition, which can be so-called preconditions in the extra sense, and with the only difference then that the now we have the convention that bottom forces all assertion, and in the Dijkstra condition, bottom forces no assertion. All of them are false at non-terminating pseudo state. So this means that if we're talking about, once again, it's the same distinction that we could make in the case of Hoare triples themselves. So either we could insist that Hoare triple is valid in a given state only if program terminates after execution of a command in this state, and then the postcondition is valid. This would be total notion that was not central for us. Or, like here, we could say that Hoare triple is valid in a given state if whenever a program terminates, if assuming that the program terminates at all, then postcondition be satisfied. So if it does not terminate, then the Hoare triple then in this partial sense is trivially valid. And this notion of weakest liberal of this WLP corresponds to this second partial or liberal reading of correctness assertions. So, in fact, we could define semantic. Why I'm talking again about Hoare triples? Well, because weakest precondition provide this machinery of weakest precondition would provide alternative way of doing reasoning about program correctness to that of Hoare triples. In fact, we could then define the validity of a Hoare triple in terms of this WLP. So a triple is valid if the under a given interpretation of logical variables, if under if the set of those states which make our assertion valid under in this fixed interpretation of program variables is contained in this semantic weakest liberal precondition. So this way of doing semantics is sometimes called predicate transformer semantics. So this is this capital WLP, we have it here as well, was something defined semantically as a set of states. So what we would like to have then on syntactic level would be some kind of a function which, given a command and a precondition, produces another precondition, a syntactic expression in our language of assertion, such that, well, first of all, the denotation of this thing is exactly this semantic function, this semantic collection of, let's show the definition again, of all the states such that C executed in this state results in a state satisfying B. And moreover, it should be provable that indeed, substituting this the output of this syntactic function, this supposed syntactic weaker liberal precondition in this Hoare triple, indeed results on in a valid Hoare triple. So assertion languages which allow such function computing this weakest liberal precondition, corresponding notion of weakest precondition, are called expressive. And because we have consequence rule in our language, expressivity would trivially imply completeness. Is it clear why? I didn't write in the slide, so maybe you should write it on the. So let's first recall the last line from the previous slide. So this is our alternative way now of defining validity of Hoare triple. And now we assume that we have, so this is, I don't know, plus, this will be, no, this will be exclamation mark, I guess, and as asterisk or star, we have. So now we want to show that our inference system satisfies the condition and this was soundness, right? So what do we do now in the opposite direction? This is how you, here you would be able to see how, in a sense, how much we are cheating here. Well, maybe let's not jump ahead. So, combining this plus, this is plus, even if it doesn't look like plus. Combining this plus with exclamation mark gives us that for all I, we have that W, L, P, C, B, I. Is contains AI if and only if our triple is holds that is valid under this interpretation. So now we in this statement here we have quantification over all interpretations, of course. So assume now best to writing, so there is no way of turning on this thing, or maybe this is not light, this is all okay, this is why everybody is confused when giving talks, because everybody is trying to switch this thing on, and this is just the old screen which was not removed. Okay, no, so I cannot make it any brighter apart from... No, it's the best. So assume now that we have that this triple is valid by the conjunction of our two conditions. This means that for every I, we have that the extension of AI, of A under I is contained in extension of this new syntactic thing. And this in turn means what? Which in turn can be rewritten as validity. Now we're talking about validity of assertions rather than entire whole triples. As the validity of A implies ELP. This inclusion, this holds for everything. This means that this thing, which is not an assertion in the assertion language, okay, of course, we have to rewrite it because I formally said that the only booleans that we have are conjunction and this actually not disjunction, but negation and conjunction. So this is how it will look like. And our star condition tells us that already our proof system is able to convince itself that the partial correctness, the Hoare triple, which has this WLP as precondition, is indeed a valid one. So these two things, by the consequence rule, give us what we want, right? So you see how much cheating is involved in using this consequence rule. We use the fact that something is semantically valid, and then we claim that this means indeed that something can be derived. But we have to have Oracle which is able to decide all assertions, including assertions of this form. Well, this form. I haven't told you yet how this thing can look like, right? I just said that assume that we have a function which, given a command and a post and an assertion, produces another assertion which satisfies these two conditions that I called plus or star, plus and star, sorry. Which I called exclamation mark and star. This would be important later on. So here is our attempt of defining such a thing, of course, inductively. And you see that most of these clauses are defined in such a way that they immediately bring to mind the axioms and rules that we postulated last time before Christmas. So the weakest liberal precondition for skip and b is just b. It's useful to keep those two postulated properties in mind. So you keep substituting this c with the thing in red on the slide and WLP itself with what is on the right-hand side of equality. So in particular, it is indeed true that B skip B holds in our proof system. In fact, this was one of the axioms, the axiom for skip, right? Similarly, it is indeed true that B with X substituted for A, precondition being B with X substituted for A, the command executed itself being A assigned to X, results in B. And we had an axiom like this last time. Maybe I should have put first axiom system because I didn't upload slides. All of you were kind enough not to protest, but I should have done it. So maybe I will first show again this proof system that I actually do protest, you know, I had a rather messy Christmas break, but it is not an excuse to forget it. So let's have a look again how those system look like last time. We had one slide with all of them put together. Yes, right. This was the proof system. Proof system which was using one axiom or one rule per one one program construct. So this was the first line was the axiom for skip. The second one was the one axiom for assignment. The third one was the one rule for sequencing. The fourth one was the one rule for conditional. The fifth one was the one rule for a while, and the sixth one was the consequence rule that I cunningly used here. Is this helpful? Do you, because we spend actually more than one lecture a day with those rules, first trying to find them semantically and then summarizing them on this one slide. So maybe it is bringing some forgotten memories from before Christmas time, because we will need now. You will see each one of those rules in axioms when of these rules in action. Sorry, when I'm going to try to show that these conditions, in particular the star one, holds. So this is the proof system that I'm talking about when I'm writing single rather than double tensile, whereas double tensile means semantic validity. Okay, let's return now to today's material. Right. So the weakest precondition for sequencing you compute simply by nesting or composing two weakest liberal precondition operators. And for conditional, you need to use a bit of Boolean-ity. This is a rather trivial. As usual, the only interesting and the only most messy thing comes with the while rule. Maybe it would have been better even to have it in a separate slide, because this is the one which you immediately notice, and rather than first looking at the trivial and easy ones, of course, the attention is immediately focused on something which looks much harder to parse. So this while rule is precisely the reason why I wanted, or I allowed myself freedom to work with a language which has infinitary conjunctions rather than ordinary quantifiers. This is not as much of cheating as it can seem. As I mentioned already, in a language with quantifiers, which also includes arithmetics, basic arithmetical operation, and some reasonable system of axioms for these arithmetical operations, you can encode quite a lot, and on the other hand, you could restrict things which can occur as conjuncts of this infinite conjunction, for example, to things that can be described by some recursive algorithm, which is precisely what is happening here. So here we have some infinite unraveling, the conjunction consists, the conjuncts are infinite family of inductively defined assertions. So yeah, for the time being, I don't think there is anything else that I should or can say here. We just will see it in action, and on every slide where I'm going to use this WLP function for a while, I'm going to remind you how this sequence looks like. And then maybe in the course of the proof, it's going to be clear how we use it. But intuitively, the idea that is captured by this infinite sequence of assertion is that you either, if you successfully execute the while loop, then you either terminate and then you result in the state where B does not, the guard of the loop does not hold anymore, or you are in the state where the guard still holds, and then you need to do one more step for which we have this one level less complex weakest liberal precondition. So now we claim, of course, that our definition works, so that these two conditions are satisfied? Yes, I'm pattern matched correctly, star and exclamation mark. So they're exactly the same symbol I was using on the blackboard. Yes, yes, I'm saying exactly the same thing. Where this thing on the right hand side of the equality on the blackboard is by definition the right hand side of this equality. And again, there is a bit of shortcut we can do because we have proved already our soundness theorem. In fact, there is almost a bit of redundancy here because of the observation I made at the beginning of the lecture. So you could do entire semantics in terms of those weakest liberal precondition, and this is why parts of the proof that we are going to see now will very much will somehow resemble the proof that we did before Christmas, which is not so bad because it didn't go very smoothly. So maybe now we have an opportunity to do it in a smoother way. Right. So this sentence here, that one half of exclamation mark, the second condition, because it consists of two halves. Right. We have equality, which means two inclusion between sets. Equality between sets is two inclusion, one from the left to right and one from right to left. So assuming that we have a show, and we have show, even if it wasn't very brilliant and smooth proof, we still show already this part. We still have shown soundness. So the claim that, yes, sorry, the claim and the implication from here to here. So now if we are able to show this, and we have this, this means that for every A, C, and B, this means in particular that it is also semantically valid that precondition W, L, P, C, B, C, P postcondition means that using it means that the set of state, using the semantic definition of the definition of validity, so using our semantics, this means that the set of states satisfying this assertion for every I will be contained in the set of those states which satisfy B after which input after being input as an argument to the semantic function partial function being the semantics of command C result in a state satisfying. So what is also nice again is that especially with all the warm-ups all the warm-up that we have is it would be apart again maybe from a while, and even then things should not be very bad. It would be practically a one-liner to show the star. It is actually one-liner which you simply obtain by comparing those two slides, one which unfortunately I did not upload, but now this evening I will upload both the slides from today and from last week. So doing the same thing as I have already started, comparing simply the definition of this WLP for skip, for assignment, for sequencing and for conditional. We will be able, you see that the star condition indeed must hold for all these clauses. Only for a while the star condition requires some effort, and I'm going to do it in two or three slides then. And similarly, it's not very difficult to handle the missing half of this exclamation mark condition. So this inclusion, inclusion from right to left. But let's see for a bit more detail how this is done. So again, we want to show that whenever we have a state in which you obtain B after execution on C, then this state satisfies this condition. Then this state satisfies this assertion. For a skip, being a state in which execution of skip results in a state satisfying B, means simply that the state itself satisfies B, because as you remember, skip, the notation of skip was just identity function. So this is this equality here. But then B itself is just what WLP or skip B was defined to be. So the proof is not even, well, I wrote it in three lines, but it's hardly even one-liner. Similar things happens for assignment, but then, and again, you don't have those slides through my negligence, so maybe let me remind you again some of the syntactic lemmas, some of the lemmas about substitution that were fighting with last time. So you remember that, sorry. You remember that assertion B being satisfied in a given state, assuming that the program variable X is in B is substituted with arithmetical expression A, that this statement is equivalent to this B itself being satisfied in a state which results in replacing for X the arithmetical constant, which, or the actual natural number, which is the denotation of expression A when interpreted by this state sigma. Recall again that our states were simply functions from the set of program variables to natural numbers. Right, so we have already discussed this fact last time. And now, using exactly the same reasoning, so this equality we obtain simply by the definition of the notational semantic of the semantics of the assignment command. And now, using this observation from slide 3 of the last lecture, we can transform this thing to this thing. And then assertion B with it should be, of course, the other way around. So this should be A replacing X, not X replacing A, is precisely how we define weakest liberal precondition for assignment command. For sequencing, this was a trivial application of induction hypothesis, and of course, a quasi trivial denotational semantics of sequencing itself, which was just partial function composition. And even analysis, it is just trivial Boolean splitting of cases that You can do on your own. So now we have, what is missing is the star close for a while, and we are also missing the missing half of exclamation mark for a while again. And let's hope that this time everything involving while is going to go a bit more smoothly. So the asterisk part is the claim that this infinite conjunction of this family of expression yields a probable or triple, probable in the proof system that I show you when substituted as precondition. And the way we prove it is by writing out such a derivation exactly as we normally do in logic. So this is what our induction hypothesis is saying for the body of the loop. We're doing induction on the complexity of program expression itself. Right? So this is already what we are assuming for any assertion in particular. So we're not doing the induction on this assertion, but on the program expression itself. And now, well, this is something that I have not shown. This is delegated to the next slide. So I'm claiming that it is semantically valid that this infinite conjunction that we define to be the weakest liberal precondition for a while, combined with the guard of the loop itself, implies this weakest liberal precondition not for the entire loop, but just for the body of the loop. And then, if I have, well, this I have by induction hypothesis, and this I have by the proof on the next slide, the consequence rule would yield us, would give us that the weakest liberal, proposed weakest liberal precondition for the while loop combined with the guard of our loop after the execution of the body of the loop, not the one iteration of the loop, results in a state satisfying again this conjunction being proposed because of a precondition for this thing. Well, this is exactly then the clause for the definition of our inference rule that we had for a while, right? If it is true that precondition, some assertion, in this case this infinite conjunction, combined with the guard of the loop after one iteration of the body loop results in the same assertion being valid, then this assertion is a good precondition for the entire while loop, and moreover, we will know that after the execution, not B holds. And then, and this actually does not require any proof, it's simply by looking at how this infinite sequence of expressions is defined, the combination, the conjunction of this entire sequence of expressions with the negation of the guard of the loop does imply B. Is it clear why? So, well, this first element of the sequence plays no role in the entire conjunction because top conjunction anything is does not change anything. And if you combine it with not B, then it means that in the entire infinite conjunction you always have to take the right disjunct in every conjunct. And in the right disjunct you always have B. So this is immediate. And to finish then the proof. proof of this part for a while. We just have to finish the proof of this question mark thing. So, as I said, I delegate it to the next slide. And using laws for infinite and finite conjunctions and disjunction, validity of this implication can be, in fact, reduced to question whether... So combining this infinite conjunction with B means that in every conjunct, you have to take the left disjunct, right? Because this is where you have B rather than not B. So if we have indeed that the conjunction of weakest liberal preconditions for one iteration or the body of the loop implies weakest liberal precondition for the body of the loop at the assertion being the entire conjunction, sorry. Then we are home. And in fact, we can even show something slightly stronger. So the antecedent and consequent of this implication are equivalent. In other words, we have some form of distributivity, infinite distributivity law for this WLP. How do we show it? Well, a given state sigma satisfies under a given interpretation of program variables this infinite conjunction, if and only if, each conjunct holds. That's the definition of satisfaction for the entire conjunction. And this by induction hypothesis. So we are proving both conditions at the same time, and we have them already proved for everything which is non-while. Means that for every n, the execution of our command in the state sigma produces something where the corresponding assertion from this infinite sequence is valid. And if this holds for every n, then the conjunction of all this, by the satisfaction definition for conjunction holds here. And we can use now induction hypothesis again to show that then we can push the infinite conjunction inside the weakest liberal precondition. Unexciting as this all is. So we're done with this thing. And now we have to prove this claim, or more specifically, one inclusion for while. This is the last clause that we have been missing. So we have to show that whenever it is the case, under given interpretation of all the variables that can be logical variables that can be presumably occurring in our assertion B, and that our assertion holds after the execution of the loop, then the state satisfies the entire conjunction, so all the elements of this sequence. So we already know, of course, that this denotation is a sum supremum, but in fact in sets or in partial functional sets, this is the same thing as set theoretical sum of this of all finite iteration of this functional starting from this empty partial function. So, in order to show that this thing applied to our sigma meaning all of these finite iterations separately, satisfying B mean that resulting in state satisfying B, assuming that they terminate at all, means that sigma satisfies all the assertions in our sequence. And for this, actually, I realized that most of our pains could have been avoided, perhaps also last time, if I first prove this trivial lemma. So, assuming that a given iteration, or n prime plus one iteration of our sequence of iteration of functionals started at the state sigma is defined, this means that there exists a suitably smaller n such that doing n many iteration of on C on sigma is precisely what the entire while loop is doing on it. This last iteration produces something, it may be, this n may be equal to zero, so it might be that already sigma itself does not satisfy the guard of the loop. So this last, or if n is non-zero, the last iteration satisfies, results in a state satisfying the negation of the guard. And for all the iteration with smaller indices, or earlier iteration of our command in this state, we have, which may be a trivial clause, of course, if the n itself is already equal to zero, then this is vacuous quantification. We have a state, we are producing a state where the guard of the loop still holds. So this is really unraveling the definition of what while loop is doing, right? If you are able to execute while loop in a given state at all, this means that you either stop, meaning where the guard of the loop is not satisfied, or you went through a sequence of states where the guard still holds, and in the end you hit a state where the guard doesn't hold at all. And this is what I have should prove, what I should have proven first last time. And this is of course proved by induction on n prime, with the base case being n equal to zero, simply. And in the inductive step, you just unfold once this definition. And with this definition, with this observation, using this lemma, we can prove that for every I, it is the case that whatever guard, command, and number of iteration we're talking about, if this thing is defined at all and it happens to satisfy B, then it means that the original state in which you started executing our loop satisfies the ith element of our sequence. Right. And now I was thinking of spending at least 20 or 30 minutes on, as I mentioned, total correctness assertion and weakest preconditions, the total weakest precondition, original the extra sense, meaning that you guarantee that program terminates, not just assuming that program terminates, it has to satisfy B. And also the notion of extraction verification conditions, although, because it's actually closest to what happens when you write the annotated program in our tool and then leave it to the FramAC or to VeriFast to check what's going on. But in fact, this extraction verification conditions again has some similarities with the proofs that, at least proving that this extraction verification condition is doing its job has quite some similarities with the proof that weakest liberator conditions are that weakest preconditions are doing its job. But at any rate, I should not spend my time on this. I think it's much more important to give Christoph a chance to start talk about new tool in the next tutorial, because I think that this week you finally want to start on very fast. Yeah, so I will turn to it later, and now I'm going to lazily switch to some earlier slides. From the previous year, to be precise. So I will update it again, of course, today when posting them online. And all right, it seems that I'm building a bad tradition of skipping extraction of verification conditions each year. But this is not where we are heading now, as I'm saying. So far we were playing around only with this toy language IMP. And on the other hand, in the tutorials, you were working with something which is almost industrial scale, shall we say, the inflammacy, and you already have plenty of opportunities to see how messy this business can be when you're working with actual real programs. And of course, actual real programs almost never deal just with this extremely simplistic approach to data input output, where everything is done by means of those program variables and pure imperative setup. But you most of the time want to deal with some kind of data structures. At the very least, in order to make our setup slightly more useful, we would need to incorporate things, I guess, like arrays, but static arrays. But still, there is much more to life if you're coding, especially in C++ or in any dynamic programming language. And typical data structures that we are talking about are lists, single or doubly linked queues, trees, stacks, and so weiter and so weiter. And of course, when you have to reason about programs involving such things, you have issues of pointers, heaps, allocations, and so on and so on. And I think that in one of the introductory lectures, I mentioned this notion of shard mutable data structure, the way it was defined by John Reynolds, namely, these structures where an updatable field can be referenced from more than one point. And of course, all those things are examples of such shared mutable data structures. So clearly, being able to do properly and in a tractable way at the same time those reasoning about such structures, data structure, is crucial to have anything that that is working for real-life programs and even real-life programming languages. And on the other hand, as you probably know, both from your own coding practice and having to struggle with stuff written by other people, this is where lots of program errors, issues, or bug arise. Where, especially if you're coding in a language which doesn't have some automatic garbage collection, when you have juggling pointers, memory leaks, segmentation faults, and so on and so on. I mentioned in one of the motivating lectures some several lists of and surveys of horrible program bugs, and you can revisit it, revisit those lists and check how many of those issues were caused precisely by juggling pointers, memory leaks, faults, and so on and so on, including even those ones involving spatial space and shuttles and rockets. So where do those problems come from? And you can, of course, argue that there is more than one reason. But, well, whatever whatever the reason is, the impressive advances, actually, we already were quite, we as a community or as computer scientists, not me myself certainly, achieve already quite good results like 15 or 20 years ago when it comes to automatic program verification. So if you move back 15 years ago, the flagship examples were Microsoft SLAM protocol. It was something that Bill Gates was so proud of that he was even mentioning this in his keynote lectures. And there were already static analyzers which were able to show the absence of any runtime errors or in the flight control software of Airbus, which is already pretty demanding thing, I would imagine. But even those things which were such so much of cutting edge that they were flagship examples for practitioners in industry and academia, they were still not very keen, for good reasons, to go into business of automatic heap verification. So just to see how it was done in case of those two examples, SLAM protocol was assuming memory safety, and yeah, that's kind of fun actually. How do you show absence of any runtime errors if you assume that there are no dynamic pointers being allocated? I don't that sounds optimistic to me. I don't know how Airbus is flying, and whenever I take a plane, I don't want to think about those things. So again, where does the pain come from? And actually, a nice short summary was provided by O'Hearn, Reynolds and Young. It is actually one of the papers that I was using, maybe not this year, but in some of the previous lectures. And their claim was that the main difficulty was not in finding in principle adequate axiomatization of program operations, like the axiomatization that we were seeing in the first half of this lecture and before Christmas, but rather from there being a mismatch between simple intuitions about the way that pointer operation works and complexity of their axiomatic treatments. So what pointer programs do is not so difficult to explain, right, or to state. It's just that when you try to convert it into this axioms and rules kind of approach, then suddenly things get quite big and messy. So why does it happen, and how exactly does it happen? When you have one pointer expression in one place in the program, but from several pointer expressions scatter across the whole program code, or even several programs running in parallel to a given same cell, and it can be modified by in different parts of the code, or even by different threads running at the same time. Then the alternation to that cell may affect values of many syntactically unrelated expressions. So it's obvious for us when we're doing semantic reasoning, well, obvious. If it was so obvious, of course, we will not have those errors. But in principle, we can see that playing around with things which are not necessarily looking the same way, but some reasonably trivial transformation can convince us that we may be accessing the same area of memory at the same time in different places. But telling exactly the computer how to infer this information, even when we have this oracle for arithmetic that we're hoping to have in our consequence rule, is not a trivial business at all. So to convince ourselves of this and to stop just being speaking in broad generalities and look at something somewhat more concrete, let us look at very trivial example of dynamic piece of code, where you just have two single linked lists, and we are assuming simplest possible memory model. So we are dealing with simplest possible type of cells, where you store the actual value in one cell and a pointer to the next cell in another. Of course, this is simplistic to the point of absurdity, but we have to start with something if we want to reason about dynamic programs. So then, piece of code which is given to supposedly the pointers or two cells where supposedly two lists start, and then you want to append one of them to the other, is obtained by iterating through the first of them, so following all those pointers. So when you hit nil, you know that you hit the end of the first list. And then you else, so this was our X, and this is our Y. And now, instead of pointing to nil, you are now pointing to the second list. Right? You appended one list to another. And of course, in order to even to express our hope, not even to show anything, but just to state the specification that the program is doing what it should, we should have some predicates in the assertion language, so on the meta level rather than object level, which explain what it means to be a linked list segment. So there is a path from X to T. Well, and actually, this is incorrect what I wrote here. There is a path from X to T, and no two elements of this path are equal. In particular, X and T itself are distinct. So we don't have a loop, right? We don't want to call a list or a list segment something of this form, or something of this form where you make a loop and then you cannot have it at all, of course. This is single linked list, but another. You have something like you cannot have something like a balloon or a lollipop where you begin with a proper segment, but then in the end you start going in circles. I will correct it later when uploading slides. So then a complete linked list, and this also shows why this is nonsensical thing to write, will be describing when we have such a predicate by saying that the segment starting at X and going to nil is indeed a linked list segment. So now our question is this a valid triple? So if you start going through from X, you will end up in nil, and you will encounter, and you will never end up in the loop. And the same thing happens when you start from Y. And then you execute this code.
Is it?
Indeed, always true, because if this is a valid triple, this has to be true under all circumstances. Assuming still the simplest possible memory model, so no complications here, that you will obtain a properly formed list, which is not an linear loop, but something going from X to nil again. What do you think? Remember again that this will be corrupted. Can anything go wrong, or who's voting for this being a valid triple? Who's voting against this being a valid triple? Okay, why? Yeah. So you need to be able to say all sorts of things, that one list is not a sublist of another, for example. They should have, but this wouldn't be enough, right? Just being, just stating that one is not sublist of another, so having like binary relation. They also should not, you also are not allowed to have a situation where they are not, neither is contained in the other, but both of them have final segment. So this was what you were already saying. So they should operate, in short, in disjoint areas of memory. Operate, I mean, they should be located. This is also something you should correct. In disjoint areas of memory. So after coming up with some way of stating suitable predicates, you now have to find suitable rules which allow you to reason about rule invariants. And again, you already have some taste that I guess how much fun it can be to find loop invariants even for static data structures, even in a simple tool like Framasi, and how reasoning about and deciding, inferring such assertions and helping again your tool to do this kind of inferences. And now, of course, this is just a small little procedure. Your program will involve the library that your program is using will use dozens of such things if you're lucky, if you're lucky, hundreds or thousands. And then you have to be able to somehow combine pieces of reasoning that you have for each of these procedures separately, assuming that each of them is correctly described with suitable pre- and post-conditions, into something bigger. So you should be able to keep, you should have some way in the language to, if you want to reason compositionally at least, to keep transferring those assumptions about being located all the time in disjoint areas in memory, even if your program uses other data structures, other areas of the heap. Remember that if your program is written in a modular way, if you have procedures, then Floyd Horde reasoning can only use this information in the contract and nothing else. So only what you explicitly start is said in pre- and post-condition. So those pre- and post-conditions should be able to allow you that to infer that nothing outside the area occupied by list starting at X, or you follow the segment starting at X, has changed. And there is a name of this problem. It's called the frame problem. It actually appeared before people tried to design workable syntactic Floyd Horde style proof systems, which can be used in industrial strength verifiers for programs involving shared mutable data structures. People realize that this kind of problems in general arise when you code at the very early days of artificial intelligence, rather than programming theory per se, in a paper by McCarthy and Hayes. some philosophical problems from the standpoint of artificial intelligence. So if you, let's say that you're formalizing a simple agent or working theory of the world or simple robot or anything that involves artificial intelligence, and try to formalize the obvious fact that you can get into conversation with Q. Well, it comes from very early days, so it was still at the days where you actually were looking things in printed phone book, then lifting the receiver and dialing number. And whichever formalization you will write in, you're almost guaranteed to miss some kind of hypothesis. Like, if a person has a telephone, you still will have your telephone after you look it up in a phone book. And of course, it's not true that every activity results in preserving the things that you have. If you set your telephone, you're fired, you don't have your telephone anymore. So you have to be able to state facts that picking up a phone book is harmless operation, or that looking into phone book results in you knowing and remembering the number. And of course, there are still more scenarios that may preclude your reasoning from being valid, like a page with a number of a given person. It was still at the time when everybody's phone number was printed in the phone book and be torn out. The agent may be blind, so he or she won't be able to look things up in phone book, and somebody may be maliciously destroying the phone book so that you are not able to look up that specific phone number anymore. And there may be a mistake made by the telephone company, or the speaking partner may have got the phone correctly, and the last edition of the phone book still does not have it. The phone system may be out of order. For example, it hit this infamous bug of AT&T that we listed on the list on the most famous program bugs or errors, or the person on the other side of the phone may be suddenly having a stroke or whatever and whatever. So when you write, these are of course trivial things for us, but then how do you distinguish between these trivial and non-trivial things when you're writing a code of your small artificial AI tool? And how do you specify which part of the state of the system are relevant and which are irrelevant, like this thing about phone book not being destroyed or your memory of phone numbers lasting for more than a few seconds versus the fact that thing may be misprinted in the phone book or that phone company may be not operating and so on and so on. So how do you frame your problem? And the fact that similar problems arise when you do Floyd Hall reasoning was discovered it was made explicit or realized not even in the context, again, on those Shermitable data structures, but it was rather in the context of object-oriented programming where people were trying to write Floyd Hall logic for inheritance issues. Very, very soon, so this is just a few years before the advent of formalism that I want at least to start talking about in the last 10 minutes of this lecture. And this is why Hall-style formalism is invented starting from late 1990s. For sure, mutable data structures use the term frame in all sorts of strange contexts. In particular, in separation logic, which is developed since by Reynolds, Ishtagen, O'Hearn, and which is probably the most prominent example of such language. And crucial rule is called the frame rule, which can be either assumed as a basic rule of our proof system. The word axiom is not a very good one. I will also correct it later. Or derived. And this separation logic proved quite flexible in adapting to other contexts when you share data structure apart from program pointers and heap and allocation. And so in particular, very, very soon it was applied to concurrency and parallel programs. An alternative approach to separation logic used the name frames in its very name. It was the setup of Casio's called Dynamic Frames, which was used in the first two or three editions of FMsoft before I took it over. And then a formalism which to a certain extent combines features of dynamic frames and separation logic was called implicit dynamic frames. And in fact, this one underlies is a theoretical foundation of the tool that you are going to start struggling with on Friday, very fast. Dynamic frames themselves, especially in the original approach of Casio's, were intended to use in the object-oriented context, but implicit dynamic frames share at least some things, including in particular the most important connective with separation logic. What is this most important connective? So the central idea of separation logic is not to think about global heap as a whole when you write or read your specifications. Instead, you think of heaplets. So you conceptually, if not physically, cut the heap into pieces, and you have to think what is the smallest or most local way of describing your program behavior. When you write a specification, you say that if a piece of code is given a heaplet satisfying P, it will not try to access heap outside of P, apart from cells possibly allocated during the execution of this piece of code C, and it will deliver a heaplet portion of the heap satisfying Q if it terminates. Of course, this has implication how the code acts on the whole global heap. It's conceptual, not physical separation. Whereas in this competing approach of Casio's of dynamic frames, we don't think in terms of of heaplets, but you use instead clauses, reads, modifies in assertions about global. Also various other things like swinging pivot postconditions and permission masks. I should have italicized all of this. It doesn't really matter what all this is because, as I said, we are focusing here on approach which is closer in spirit to separation logic. And assertions about disjoint heaplets are combined using something, a connective which is called spatial conjunction or separating conjunction or independent conjunction. Logicians would call it fusion, maybe, or you can simply call it a star or asterisk, if you wish. Again, logical community has been studying such things in completely independent, or at least differently motivated setups, although in hindsight you can see all the logics mentioned here, like linear logics, relevant logics, fuzzy logics, but especially linear and maybe relevant logics, as also dealing with some notion of resource, logical notion of resource. Reynolds was not looking, the inventor of separation logic was not looking so much as those logical formalism, he was rather inspired by an early work of Rod Borstal in program analysis. But this is historical detail that you may or may not be interested in. And so you remember that in case of IMP, we had programming language itself. And on the meta level, you had this language of assertion, which was using Boolean expressions, maybe quantifiers, or in our case, infinite conjunctions. So here in the assertion, so this is of course something which occurs only in this separating conjunction or spatial conjunction is only something which occurs in the meta level in the logic where you used to reason about programs, not the code itself. The code itself can and should be written in some more standard programming language. And if you don't look at entire whole triples, but just at the logic governing those assertions, The logic itself is sometimes called not, it was first known before separation logic was fully formed as the logic of bunched implications. The name actually comes from proof theory of some of those logical formalisms. So, to make this rather abstract discussion a bit closer to what we are talking about right now, we had this problematic triple here, and the way you state such specifications in separation logic is precisely by using the separating conjunction. This was the restriction that we wanted, that was proposed and that we wanted to make, that those two lists are located in disjoint heaplets in different parts of memory. There is not much, it's not invention worthy of Nobel Prize, although actually people involved in this got all kinds of prizes in theoretical computer science. As I said at the beginning, the problem here is not to realize what's going on, because it took us less than 1 minute to realize where the problem lies. It's a good way of stating this kind of thing syntactically in such a way that you can then compose pieces of reasoning into larger inferences, like inferences that we had, I don't know, for a while or whatever. And the frame rule that I was talking about, which is at the heart of those separation logic like formalisms, is simply saying that under a suitable condition, namely that the program is not messing around with variables or messing around, sorry, I should not say messing around because this sounds too semantics. So you can define a syntactic predicate saying that no variable occurring in dangerous position of assertion A is mentioned in the code of C, occurs in the program expression C itself, then you can extend this local information. So here you are only talking about this restricted part of the memory, to whichever other heaplets, maybe even heaplet covering the entire remaining part of the heap you add here. So this rule is how you progress, how you move from local specification to global specification. I will try to give you some examples of inferences which are using this rule, at least for the most obvious dynamic program constructs. Of course not today. And well, okay, I said that this, I'm saying on the slide that this premise needs to be and will be suitably formalized, and I already sketched how the formalization will look like. The original logic of bunch implication has other connectives like magic wand, which is, if you think of fusion itself as a kind of conjunction, then this magic wand is a corresponding implication. Mathematicians would use words like adjoints, residuals, or whatever, but it is useful, in fact, just like ordinary implication was used here for deriving weakest preconditions in this formalism. Sorry, you cannot see non-classical logics in computer science because this lecture is not happening this year. And actually, it may be a good idea to run it again next year. And also, I don't think that implicit dynamic frames are using this magic wand, whereas the separating conjunction occurs both in separation logic and IDF. Right, so this is where I have to stop. Unfortunately, I'm exactly at the moment where I wanted to stop. So, to be continued next week.